Ready to take a deeper look at where history, politics, and economics all intersect? Well, then you've come to the right place. Each week, here's where we pull back the headlines and focus on the big trends, the stuff that actually shapes our future. Through the noise, we focus on the signal. I'm your host, Neil Howe, and this is Demography Unplugged. Today is June 30th, 2020, and this is Demography Unplugged. Welcome back, everybody. As I did last week, I have on my podcast my fellow millennial analyst, Christian Ford, who I guess is right now still down east in Maine. Did I say that right, Christian?
Yep, you said it right.
it's neither down nor east, but I like the fact that you have special regional ways of talking. We are losing that in America, aren't we?
Yeah.
Well, other than, getting at Maine, I still remain here in the environs of Washington, D.C., and everything's heating up a little bit, not in terms of locally, but in terms of COVID. We're going to get to that. As always, I do want to mention at the beginning, if you want to dive deeper into everything we talk about on this podcast, please consider subscribing to our research product, Demography Unplugged, which I put together with my team here at Hedgeye Risk Management. You can Google it, find out about it. Among other things, you will be able to get our newswire, all of our special reports, my show on COVID-19, which I will be doing again this Thursday at 12:30, and special interviews with guests and all the rest. So we got, once again, a large agenda today. Let me just name the high points. We're going to start out as usual with markets and U.S. economic indicators. We're going to move behind the markets and indicators. I think on the negative side, we'll be talking about COVID-19 resurging. We're going to be more on the demoralization side. We're going to be talking about crime resurging and about Trump approval ratings continue to fall. And I will say that this is something we predicted, I believe, about 6 weeks ago, that once we start surging again, I believe we said sometime around the middle of June or late June, that the mood of the country will actually get a lot worse. I think we see that happening right now. On the mix side, we are seeing certain signs of a reappearance or an upward inflection in inflation expectations, at least on the horizon, and the teetering odds of further stimulus, which we're going to get to. Whether or not that's positive or negative all depends on whether it's inflation with or without growth and how much of it we get, and a few things we'll talk about later. We're going to go abroad. We'll talk about economic indicators, which I guess are this month limited to China. We'll go around the world a little bit with special focus on China's new law abrogating Hong Kong's home rule. As I've always said, Christian, I think that's a sleeper that could have enormous mm-hmm. implications for the world. Obviously, short term in terms of trade, but geopolitical tensions rising very quickly because of that. We have a Newswire story we're going to do. It's on how the pandemic has flattened services to the wealthy, which is really a window into how absolutely atypical this recession is. In which sectors it's hitting, almost the opposite of a typical recession. And finally, I really want to do this week, Christian. We're going to talk about Joe Biden's Slow Joe, as Trump calls him, his potential VP picks. And we do want to get to those because I think those are, for obvious reasons, more important than usual. So with that, why don't we just jump into markets, Christian.
All right. Well, over the last five trading days, the S&P 500 is down 2%, and the global Dow is up is also down 1.6%. And for volatility, the VIX is at 31.78, which is almost exactly the same spot it was last week.
Yeah, kind of hanging up there, a little bit higher than it was about 3 or 4 weeks ago.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about, I guess first of all, about economic indicators. I think we had a scattering of them. None of them looked all that great, but maybe you could mention where we are with those.
Right. So we got personal income month over month for May. Now, that was down 4.2%. Now, if you remember, Neil, in April, that skyrocketed to 10.8%. But that was because in April, they were including the stimulus checks as part of people's personal income. And obviously, no one's getting those in May because they were a one-time thing. So that's why you see this negative.
Well, and that, but that's not the only thing. We were also delaying income taxes. Yeah. And we're just doing all kinds of things to create instant income. Right.
Right. And we also got personal spending month over month for May, and that was at 8.2%. Now, interestingly enough, in April, it was at negative 12.6%. So you kind of have this switch with personal income was really high in April, now lower in May, and personal spending was really low in April, now high in May.
But we are still up on personal income, I think 7% over where we were in February, and we're still down in terms of personal spending. So the savings rate remains very elevated, and if you're a Keynesian, you're concerned about aggregate demand. I mean, that's obviously a demand hit. We're going to talk a little bit later about, you know, supply hit and demand hit as ingredients in a recession. But yeah, what else do you see?
We also got the Kansas Manufacturing Index for June. That came in at 2, but that missed its expectations of 8. So there's still a little bit of growth, but really not much there. We also got the Dallas Fed Manufacturing Index that came in at negative 6.1 for June. You know, interesting about that index, Neil, in the last 12 months, that has contracted 9 of those months. So even before COVID, this wasn't
right. That well, high. This is energy, so that's just been a bad scene. Yeah.
And then finally, we got Chicago PMI for June. Now, this came in at 36.6, but was expected to be at 45. So that really missed the expectations.
Now, that's an unusual. This is not the Chicago Fed. This is that what is it called? BMI. It's both a manufacturing and
Chicago.
Yeah,
barometer.
It's a manufacturing and demand. I think it's put out by the Supply Institute for the ISM, right? Institute for Supply Management.
Right.
An interesting one, actually one that serves very well, as I recall, as a recession indicator. We used to say it's one of our favorite indicators. But yeah, that looks really terrible. At 35, that's a three handle several months after the recession started. Anything else?
Those are the main ones, I would say, for the U.S. I don't know if you want to go into international
off. I did promise to say something about some of the negatives. Clearly, what the markets are responding to is not these indicators coming in, but the prospects of the future, and that is rising cases all over America. I mean, we're up at around 45,000 cases a day. Yes, we're testing a lot more, but even the positive rate is beginning to go back up again on these tests. We see rising cases right now, and if you take a 7-day average in 35 states, we see no change in 13 states. We see declining cases in only 3 states now, Maryland, Rhode Island, and D.C. Not big ones either. So there you are. According to RNOT, the website, we see 35 states now with RNOT over 1, 10 states with RNOT over 1.2, and 1.2 is typically the dividing line between, you know, growing and really growing, right? I mean, this is an exponential growth rate. EPA forecast now says that every state, I'm actually looking at the EPA forecast map right now, but virtually the entire United States is orange, except for the very upper upper Great Plains states and Indiana and some of the North Atlantic states, including Maine, by the way. But, you know, you can throw in New York and Vermont and Massachusetts and a couple of others. That's it. So this is a huge issue, again, because what's going to happen is this is the demoralization, right? States are going to reverse course. I mean, we've seen this already happen. I think Texas and Florida are already closing the bars back up. You know, that's when you know it's really hard, right? And you're going to see that you're going to see basically everyone begin to reverse course. And I think this change in direction, that's where the demoralization comes in. It's like, oh, my God, you mean we shut down in late March, April, early May, and then what? We're all up to close down again. Where is this going to go? And as I've said often on my COVID report, we have no hope of a real containment strategy in this country, right? So everyone's beginning to see it's just going to seesaw back and forth between opening up and letting the economy breathe until we have so many cases that people think it's a danger, then closing back up again, seesawing back and forth with really no hope, right? I mean, there's no resolution. And I don't want to go back through here all the arguments again, but containment is an actual strategy, which takes more than just shutting down. It takes really shutting down, getting cases very small and local. It involves, you know, testing and tracing and self-isolation and quarantine. And, you know, you feel like around the world, countries are really do this. But we're nowhere near, and I think there's no leadership, not just at the national level, but frankly, even at the state level. So this is definitely demoralizing. And to add to that, this is very recent. It's just in the last few days. Reports of rising crime. We saw huge declines in crime, and we reported on that during the lockdown. We saw some of the lowest crime rates we've ever seen, actually, during the months of, particularly in April and May. Now that's rapidly turning around, both to the opening up, so people are much more used to being out in the streets. So obviously criminals can be out on the streets without being noticed. That was actually a big issue when things were closed down. A lot of offenders have been released from prisons and jails, and police report in many cities talk about demoralization, but they're just a little bit less, Christian, aggressive in enforcement. And as you recall, all of the discussion about defunding the police, I absolutely do think that that plays a role into it. According to even the head of the New York City police, he says, yeah, that plays a role into it. But, you know, police are a little bit less aggressive about responding to stuff. The Police Executive Research Forum surveyed four cities. And this is Indianapolis, Milwaukee, New York City, and Las Vegas. And they found huge rises in the last 3 weeks in all these cities. In Atlanta, and as you recall, that was one of the big incidents back there about a guy who took a policeman's taser or something like that. I mean, whatever happened, a guy was shot. And in the first 3 weeks of June, there have been 75 people shot on the streets in Atlanta versus 35 in the same 3 weeks a year ago. And so this is shot up to the top of the news in downtown Atlanta. New York City last week saw 52 shootings. This is the worst since 2012. And interestingly, this is another little tidbit, 20% of those released from Rikers Island have been rearrested. So there you go. You know, they'll turn up sooner or later. I don't know what we're going to do with them, re-release them. Anyway, I just think this is an issue. And look, I think Americans on all sides believe that we've just got a huge problem here. I think people do see there's a real injustice in how we enforce laws in the United States and our police system and how the police are trained and their operating procedures, no question about that. You know, on the other hand, they're obviously on the streets for a purpose, and you've got to work with this institution somehow. And I, for some reason, the police have been drawn into the polarization of everything else in America in a way which I don't see any resolution at the moment. That takes us to Trump's approval ratings. They continue to decline. This is real clear politics, summary of polls. 56% now disapprove of Trump, 41% approve. This is about the lowest he's been since that horrible first year he had in 2012. If he goes down any lower, he will be back in that first year territory, which I'm sure he doesn't want to repeat. And as you move along, you see that's reflected in the futures markets, which are now predicting by 64% Biden, 38% for Trump. That's the widest margin we've seen in futures markets. Interestingly, speaking of futures markets, if you look, the odds that Trump will be nominated, believe it or not, is only 87%. I don't know what people expect to happen. and in Biden, it's only 91%. I can actually imagine scenarios in which either of those people won't be nominated at the last moment. Very different scenarios. I'll just leave it at that. Right. But speaking about demoralization and speaking about declining Trump approval ratings, let's talk a little bit about John Bolton's new book, The Room Where It Happened. Apparently very detailed and very unflattering portrayals of Trump in negotiating with world leaders. I don't know. What's the reaction to that book been, Christian?
Well, you know, classic, you can assume the Democrats are horrified about what they read. But what's more interesting is how are the Republicans reacting? And, you know, some Republicans are defending Trump and saying, don't believe the book. But noticeably, people have been looking at who's not talking. You know, you got Susan Collins, Maine senator, Cory Gardner, he's up for re-election as well, Mitt Romney, Marco Rubio. These are all people who are noticeably not commenting to reporters when they're asked. So there's some feeling that maybe there is a little bit of concern among some of the more moderate wings of the Republican
Party. Yeah, I think in general the feeling has been, even among Republicans, that, yeah, it sounds like most of it really happened. But it's all news, you know, right. It's like, that's Trump, yeah. You know, that's just the way he is. I think one of the most remarkable things about the conversations told in the book is this contrast between how he tries to do everything impossible to impress and what is the word I'm looking for, Christian? Kind of play up to autocrats around the world. He sort of, you know, kowtows to them, and he's very deferential to them. But when it comes to our allies, you know, particularly some of the conversations related between him and Theresa May or Angela Merkel, were just scathing. I mean, just openly in the conversation, calling Angela Merkel dumb. You know, that's a dumb thing to do, you know, stuff like that. Really interesting, and it's a little bit of psychology into Trump. You know, he loves powerful guys. He just thinks, you know, he can deal with them. He wants to, I don't know, alternatively flatter them and impress them. But it was even true, you know, with Emmanuel Macron, where he first went to Paris, and Macron, very smartly, I think, very shrewdly, held a huge military, you know, invited Trump when there's a big military celebration. You know what the French are, you know, with their military, you know, Force de Frappe and all this stuff. Anyway, you know, Trump was just amazed. He was, like, really impressed. And, you know, ever since, you know, he and Macron have had this sort of special relationship. It's a really interesting feature of Trump, and I don't think one that, you know, overall is a flattering portrayal. Meanwhile, much more predictably, and of course, John Bolton is a conservative. I think that's why the book was so concerning. I mean, John Bolton is a, you know, a right-winger's right-winger, and ironically, completely converted Trump to his side on the whole issue of Iran and the repudiation of the treaty. That really, I mean, we associate it with Trump, but it was really John Bolton's original, you know, crusade, right, to reverse the detente with Iran. There's another feature story out by Carl Bernstein, full of quotes from about two dozen people who were on calls with Trump, basically saying the same thing, but, you know, who's, that's all much more predictable. I mean, Carl Bernstein is the guy who gave us the Watergate, all the Watergate stories. And, you know, everyone knows which side he is on. But yet one other interesting story. This one surfaced, I think, originally by the New York Times, and that is the Vladimir Putin bounties to the Taliban. Maybe you can tell us a few details of that one. That one actually could be explosive if we ever have the concrete deal details underlying it.
Right, Neil. So the New York Times reported that there is an intelligence briefing that supposedly went to the White House that said Putin was paying bounties to the Taliban to kill American, UK, and NATO soldiers. Now, where it really gets explosive is that they claim the White House was briefed on this, but Trump did nothing to either punish Putin or Russia. Now, Trump claims he's never heard of it. There seems to be some kind of argument about whether they were briefed or not. The intelligence services, they can't all agree on whether this is actually a true report or not. There is a report. We know it's there.
Yeah, I should add, too,
the information
there actually is some tangible evidence. Apparently, they broke into a Taliban hideout and found loads of cash.
I think it was half.
Right, and
dollars.
it was apparently traced directly back to Russia that was paying this cash to go after America. Anyway, continue. I didn't want to interrupt.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you saw this, Neil, but the Associated Press has now reported that the White House was actually briefed on this as far back as 2019. So it's he said, she said, you know.
Well, you know.
If they can actually prove that Trump knew and didn't do anything, this could be.
Well, it will be explosive.
Can you prove that?
Yeah, but you know, Vladimir, he's my bro, you know. I mean, you know, he wouldn't do anything like that. I mean, but you're absolutely right, and just what the stakes are. And I think they claim that they have documentation that at least one soldier was killed, you know, for a bounty. I mean, it really doesn't matter how many, right?
Right.
In fact, it doesn't matter if any were killed at all, mm-hmm. just that this was going on. This is going to be interesting to watch. Last but not least, I just wanted to comment a little bit on the this is a mixed positive and negative, and that's evidence of the reinflation of the economy. We've seen lately, you know, gold has been rising, energy's been gradually rising, industrial metals, obviously, copper. China seems to be recovering its economy. Obviously, China's been hit flat on its back, but it does look as though in this calendar year, China will nonetheless salvage a positive GDP for the year of maybe only 1%, and it may technically have gone into a recession of 2 quarters, and of course that would be historic enough. But it looks as though it's gearing up its investment again, right? I mean, they got their industrial plant going, and they're buying a lot of copper again, and the U.S. dollar is declining as well. These are all indicators of long-term, at least medium or long-term inflation, you know, at least on the second derivative beginning to show, you know, kind of convex going back up. And whether it's benign inflation, which is accompanied by positive economic growth, or stagflation is unclear, I think for the time being, if it shows up anytime in the near future, I think you could assume this could be stagflation given where the American economy is going. And a couple of interesting sidelights on that. M2. Now, this is the standard measure of the monetary stock. This is basically all currency and bank deposits people have, has skyrocketed over the last 3 months from $5.5 trillion to $18.4 trillion in just 3 months. In June 15th, year over year, it has risen at a 25% annual rate. Now, historically, if you look back over the past 20, 30 years, you know, the money supply grows at an annual rate at the very lowest at about 0%, and at the very highest, about 10%. So we've never seen a 25% annual growth rate over 3 months, any time within living memory, I think you could say. But later on, this could fuel inflation. And it's interesting, Jeremy Siegel, many people may know of Jeremy Siegel. He's a professor of finance at the University of Pennsylvania. he's sort of your eternal optimist on stocks. He's, you know, invest in stocks for the long run. It's always a good moment to invest for Jeremy. He says it will spur a consumer boom in 2021 and ultimately to inflation. And here I actually can agree with Jeremy. It will, I think it does have the danger of forcing inflation, although who knows how soon it may happen. But the thing that Jeremy does not talk about is inflation is the one thing that will force the Fed's hand, right? Because that's the one thing that will stop all the punch bowl celebration by the Fed, right? If you want the Fed to actually pull the punch bowl away, just introduce a little inflation. And that could cut the S&P 500 boom short really fast. And this actually, you know, echoes a theme that I talked about a little bit last week in talking about the fourth turning. If you really want to look at ways of getting out of the constant, you know, sort of extend and pretend and just keep leveraging up the stimulus, which seems to be our current response of both Congress and the Fed, inflation is definitely one way that will happen, right? You know, the Fed can't sit back while inflation begins to accelerate. But what it does mean, as long as people are convinced that the Fed is going to nail that yield curve to the floor for the next 2 years, as they promised, is it does promise an absolute boom in borrowing, right? Everyone's going to leverage up. And tell me that's not going to lead to inflation. So I have this wonderful quote here from CalPERS. Now, many of you know CalPERS is the, you know, California public pension system, one of the largest, you know, public pension systems in the world. And this is Ben Meng, CIO of CalPERS. And he's announced just a couple of days ago that he was working for ways to improve the rate of return on CalPERS to the 7% he needs, you know, to satisfy all of their pension obligations by seeking a higher return on their assets and, you know, either to look for assets with higher returns or to increase their amount of assets. Well, how do you do that? How do you increase your amount of assets? Leveraging, right? So he's looking at private equity and maybe other means of leveraging. So in return for less liquidity and a lot more volatility, you can get a higher rate of long-term return. So this is the world of zero interest rates, right? And this is, but I guess my question would be, what happens when everyone does it, right? Okay, we're all convinced there's going to be zero interest rates. Well, everyone's going to want to leverage up, right? I mean, you'd be a fool. Not if you think there's a positive return, you think that interest rates are going to, you'll leverage up, right? So you push up valuations on the S&P, and especially in privately held companies. Obviously, private equity thrives at a time of next to zero interest rates, particularly guaranteed next to zero interest rates. But it's self-defeating if everyone does it. The lesson of my story is leverage begets leverage. And when the Fed says, you know, we're going to, you know, leverage up and we're going to monetize the debt, we're going to keep interest rates real low, well, that just basically gives free license for everyone else to leverage as well. And just as another exclamation point on that, the Department of Labor, and this shows you where the White House is. I mean, the White House loves this stuff, right? I mean, debt will save us. The Department of Labor issued guidance allowing 401k plans to invest in private equity firms. Okay, get that. We're hitting our worst recession than anyone can remember. And we're actually now under the CARES Act allowing people to pull money out of their 401k plans, right, so they can survive. And many people are doing it. We actually had a Newswire item, I think. What was the figure? 33% of millennials either have or plan to pull their money out of their 401k, right, so they can live on. Now they can do it penalty-free under CARES. So that's the reality. But the response, let's democratize more debt. It's all okay if we just let people leverage up and get them even, right? I don't know whether to laugh or cry, Christian. I mean, this is what we do, right? Leverage up what's left in those 401k plans. You can be like Ben Meng of CalPERS. You know, take money out, but then leverage up the rest. Anyway, words fail me. I'm not going to dwell much time on that. But I think there is a real sense of unreality there. All that said, let's move on. Do we have any global indicators we want to talk about?
Yeah, we have two we want to talk about out of China. So we got the NBS manufacturing PMI for June, which came in at 50.9. So it is above 50, so technically growing slightly. The reason it's so low is because exports keep contracting right. as the world plunges further into
Japan, China's a master at that, right? I mean, you know, no export demand, but they can really just decide to pump up the domestic demand. And God knows whether whatever it is they're building domestically has any economic value at all, right? That's the problem. We have that same problem evaluating the economy of the USSR back in those days. You know, was any of that plant and equipment that we're building worth anything? Well, we didn't know. We didn't have a market to evaluate it. But, you know, cheer up. Pretty soon we won't have a market left in the United States to evaluate it either. Oh, well. Continue, though.
Well, we also got the NBS non-manufacturing PMI for June, and that was at 54.4, which was actually above expectations of 52.1.
Services a little bit
above
higher.
May's numbers. I can see.
Well, it's obviously not so much exports, and that you know, reflating domestic demand there makes a bigger difference. Well, then let's move on to going around the world. I know you have a we have three great items, but I think your first one is India and TikTok. That sounds interesting.
Well, Neil, if you remember last week, we talked about this border dispute between India and China. It was hand-to-hand combat. Really gruesome, grisly stuff happened. And the Indian government was quite upset about it. And they announced on Monday that they are banning 59 Chinese apps from being used in the country. And this includes TikTok. Now, India is TikTok's biggest overseas market with over 200 million users. They say that the app is a security risk. You know, there's been a lot of questions of whether they mine people's data and under Chinese law, whether they have to give that to the Chinese government. They claim they don't, but if you take a look at the laws, it seems like
It's the same thing with 5G. Look, it's the same thing with all these issues. There is no real separating, you know, China's government from their private sector. But this does if I'm right about this, we have the same debate over TikTok in the United States, right? I believe the military has been banned in the military.
Military, Homeland Security, most of the security agencies have banned it.
So I guess it's just what? Just teenagers at home. I mean, I mean, is that right? I mean, it's just basically, so your kids are the only ones that can, who are allowed to use it.
Yeah.
I should say our kids, you know, all of our kids, right? What's happening to the dispute? I remember that was an incredibly grisly description you had last week. This was, hand-to-hand combat. Wow. And this new policy comes straight from Narendra Modi, I'm sure.
Exactly, right. Most people are saying this is a direct reaction to the border dispute, which, you know, it was questionable. Is India actually going to act or is it going to be mostly words? And this was a strong action.
And but, you know, India has been moving steadily closer to the United States for a while. I mean, this is really since 9/11. Right. They've been, you know, moving in our orbit for various reasons. So what else is going on?
Well, in France, they held local elections. Now, this is mostly about mayors and city councils, so nothing that would actually affect the parliament. But the big news, the clear winner was the Green Party. You know, Macron's, most of his candidates actually lost. You know, his backed candidate for the mayor of Paris lost to actually the Socialist Party. And Macron has had to come out and say that he's going to support a more green agenda coming forward because that seems to be what the people wanted. Another very interesting and strange thing that happened in the election was that the Prime Minister, Edouard Philippe, he was running for a mayor of a small city. Now, he actually won, and under the French Constitution, he can appoint someone to be the mayor in his place until he wants to take over. Now, most people were asking, why is the sitting prime minister also running for a mayor position? There's been some rumors that Macron is unhappy that Philip has actually become more popular in the polls and that he might dump him come the next election. And Philip was trying to...
You know, back in the old days, and the clergy would have, we would have called this pluralism, right? I mean, having several benefices and sort of pointing other people to preach and the ones, but getting the money from all of them. That is fascinating. You can actually run for election and appoint someone. Wow. That's amazing. My understanding, though, is very interesting that the Green Party has very little national profile. It's not really a national party, as it is a very important national party, for instance, in Germany now, that's still at the national level. It's expected that Macron's biggest opposition will be from the National Front. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. The local parties and national aren't exactly coordinated in France.
Right, and I don't even know what these local officials do, since there's so much, you know, dirigism, you know, top-down direction in France. Right. It's a little unlike our own system. Well, finally, let's move over to the new China law. I think that's a sleeper. The media is paying surprisingly little attention to it, but I think this could be a big deal.
Yeah, so there's been this China security bill that's a little mysterious. It just passed today, and we still don't actually know what it says. They've given us some idea that Chinese security agencies will be able to operate in Hong Kong for the first time. And they've also said that it will make secession and collusion with foreign powers illegal. Now, most people say that this is China taking over Hong Kong. You know, tomorrow is actually the 23rd anniversary of Britain returning Hong Kong to China. And the reason they have pushed this bill through so fast is they are preparing for probable protests tomorrow. And, you know, we've talked about it, Neil, that you could see some of these protesters disappear forever. You know, it's a little unclear, but it's going to be a top-down crack on them.
Well, and, you know, apparently even Carrie Lam, who's the chief executive of Hong Kong, does not know what's in this bill.
Right, no one knows.
Isn't that amazing? She's actually said that. She didn't even know what's in it. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether she's telling the truth or not. She probably knows darn well what's... I mean, you know, right. She probably knows what it implies for her and what her powers will be, or more importantly, what her powers will not be. I mean, she's stuck totally in the middle here, right?
Right.
And now she's despised by both sides, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it turns out the democracy, you mentioned that there was some announcement that the democracy movement, or at least its public its public leaders, have sort of disbanded.
Yes.
Is that a ploy, or is that, what's behind that?
So there's technically a pro-democracy opposition party in Hong Kong. It's called the Demo Suscito, and their leaders have disbanded the party. They say with this new bill, it's over. They think that the ploy for democracy and keeping Hong Kong free is, there's no chance. And they think it's dangerous to continue with the protests. They're worried what's going to happen with their followers and supporters if they continue this fight.
All right. So two issues to me, as I see it. And this really makes the difference between whether or not this is going to be a big geopolitical issue, and really could change the direction of the world to some extent. And that is, what is happening to that legislation which was just passed along with the resolution in the Congress, which was, by the way, bipartisan, I think even unanimous, right?
Yeah, it was unanimous.
I think we need to bring that into it.
Yeah, so the Senate unanimously passed this bill that basically what it says is that any Chinese official who helps undermine the autonomy of Hong Kong will have sanctions put against them. Now, the really interesting part, Neil, is that any financial institution that helps these people will also have sanctions placed against them. Now,
right. And that's the killer. That's right. The killer. That one phrase is the killer. Look, no one cares if these officials themselves have get their visa withdrawn or, you know, they can't vacation in Florida or anything. But the idea that there's sanctions against the institution, this is, by the way, exactly how Trump did the stranglehold on Iran, right? I mean, that's why Iran is now a pariah and why its economy has been contracting for several years in a row. Imagine if that happened suddenly on China, just simply through following through with the letter of the law. Where does this law stand? It was passed unanimously in the Senate. Is that right?
Right. Still has to go through the House and be signed by Trump.
Okay. Well, the House is going to go through with it.
Right.
No problem. Because the House think, you know, if Joe Biden's been lampooning Trump is soft on China, the House will absolutely go through with it. And then Trump's going to be in a really difficult position, right? Because, well, you know, Uncle Xi, he wants to, you know, doesn't want to get into all that political stuff, all the Democratic stuff. And we got a trade deal, you know, he still hopes is on. I don't know. They got that trade deal there. He still wants to, you know, have maneuvering room. On the other hand, I guess there is a chance that the two houses may come back and approve it over Trump's veto, which would be enormously humiliating for the president. I can't remember the last time we had a legislation passed over the president's veto, at least an important piece of legislation. Of course, in the long run, it's actually up to Trump to enforce it.
Right.
And we don't know. Now, that's the real question to me. And the real question as to whether Trump will enforce it, to me, is all going to be dependent on what happens in Hong Kong and how that's perceived by the world, right? So here's what China wants. China wants shock and awe. China just wants, no one's going to be on the streets in Hong Kong. Just the fear of this thing will just render, you know, all of the demonstrators, just make them all disappear. So they won't even come out. There won't be any incidents, right? And right. As I believe that China is now saying, and I think Carrie Lam's echoing the same thing, we're not really, we don't even need this thing, right? It's just, if it does happen, right? So it's a little bit like the you know, European Central Bank, you know, promising to back up sovereign debt of the individual countries. Once you announce it, you never need to use it. That's what they want. All that would it take for this to get suddenly into the front pages of everyone's newspaper and force everyone to react, right, would be some incident to take place on the streets of Hong Kong, or easily what I could see is a few highly visible protesters who simply disappear.
Right.
And everyone knows what happened to them, right? They were hustled out of Hong Kong and they're God knows where they are. To me, and that would, even Trump, that would force his hand. I don't think Trump really wants to do this, but he may decide in that case, okay, I need to go with this. I can't fight it. I will do a showdown with China. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It could just, Trump kind of knows he has to go one way or the other, and he either has to resist it or ride it. And I think it's really uncertain. I don't think Trump has any real conviction in this, but he's willing to go either way if it would help him. But I do think this is extremely serious, and the media has been underrating its possible importance, because if these things are enforced, wow, I mean, that could suddenly take a lot of the world's trade and bring it to a screeching halt. As well as obviously hugely inflame, even further the relationship between the United States and China, in that whole area of the Western Pacific. So, with that, I do want to move on to this piece, which is about the pandemic and how it's flattened services to the wealthy. And this was a piece, an interesting piece in the New York Times, which cited some interesting data by Opportunity Insights, which is a Harvard think tank. But it touches on something I think that's really interesting, that if you look back in most post-war recessions, they follow a typical pattern. They're triggered in the first instance by a demand shock. That is to say, people suddenly choose, you know, to spend less. And the first firms to get hit by this shock are mainly large companies in big companies, housing, mining, manufacturing, consumer product goods, and all that. And those who first feel the pain from higher interest rates and inventory backups, and the first workers to get hit are low-income workers in industrial regions, far from where wealthy people live. And that was certainly the case back in 2008, 2009. It's just typically the case we've seen in recessions. This recession is completely different on all counts. This recession was, first of all, triggered by a supply shock. Firms cannot produce or sell to customers, right? And the first firms to get hit this time are mainly small companies or sole proprietorships in the service sector, not in manufacturing. And we're talking about personal services especially. And the first workers to get hit this time around are low-income workers, low-income earners, yes, but they are in affluent urban areas very near to where wealthy people live. And I think you saw some of this come out even in the George Floyd demonstrations, right? Where you saw, you know, that's where the demonstrations were. What kind of services are we talking about? I mean, we're talking about, small firms, contractors, professionals who provide services to wealthy people in relatively wealthy neighborhoods. Think about high-end restaurants, boutique and fashion shops, spas, gyms, therapists, theaters, floor. I mean, you could go on, right? I mean, all this kind of stuff. And we have a detailed breakdown by Opportunity Insights. It's absolutely fascinating. It shows a direct correlation by daily in terms of businesses in zip codes in the highest income districts. Highest income zip codes got hit the most. And those in the lowest income zip codes got hit the least. And that's true both in employment loss and in revenue loss. So for example, in downtown Manhattan, businesses got absolutely floored. But if you look at, Harlem or South Bronx, you know, relatively unscathed, right? So that may ask yourself, what are the rich doing with their money? And for the last couple of months, they haven't been spending it. We just went through those numbers, right? We actually started out this podcast with those numbers. They're not spending that. And most of this increasing savings is coming from the wealthy. Past recessions have usually been accompanied by some rise in the personal savings rate, with a disproportionate share coming from the affluent. But this time, we're seeing a grotesquely exaggerated response. The average personal savings rate skyrocketed to 33% in April. I think that's the highest month ever, you know, since we've been keeping records. And nearly all of this gain has come from the affluent. So there you have it. According to these Harvard researchers, over half of the consumption decline in April and May came from the top quartile of households. Meanwhile, the lowest quartile has seen almost no decline in consumption, partly because they have fewer choices about declining. I mean, they have to eat and at least try to pay the rent, but also partly due to, you know, PPP, the unemployment insurance bonus dollars and so on. And you can actually see that in the bottom quartile, you really see no overall decline in total income. And that's due to the stimulus. Now, the stimulus is obviously not doing the same thing for for the wealthy. I mean, it's keeping their businesses going, but it's certainly not replacing their consumption. And so there you have it. You want to look at who's getting hit the most. Businesses, Beverly Hills, Sausalito, Chicago's Magnificent Mile. And by the way, all of those places, and we talked about that in an earlier broadcast, is where, you know, Black Lives Matter meets the 1% movement. And that's what you absolutely saw in those places. And a very different texture to this recession. There's no question about it. And as we've just been saying, it may not be over. You know, we may be soon in for, you know, a whole nother surge, right? And we'll see how that goes. And by the way, there's one thing we didn't get much chance to talk about, and that is whether or not we'll see more stimulus spending, you know, whether we will see a CARES 5. And we don't know yet. I can't remember exactly the dates of that. I do believe that Congress is coming back on the week of, I guess it's 3 weeks, July 20th to August 7th. But it's very uncertain now whether they'll pass anything. I know Mitch McConnell says, you know, he wants to make sure that they have liability protection. Businesses have liability protection. The Democrats are saying no way. Mitch McConnell saying there's no way he's going to pass that huge HEROES Act that the Democrats pass. Anyway, it's very unclear that anything's going to happen in 2 weeks. But then they go on vacation again, and they won't be back until Labor Day, Christian.
Right.
So it's a really interesting question. It could go either way. And obviously, if there is no stimulus, you could have a lot of workers and a lot of businesses in real trouble if the economy starts shutting down again in particular. So last but not least, because as always, we are always run out of time, but I promise to do this. We do want to get into it. And that is Joe Biden's potential vice presidential candidates. And this is obviously more than the usual interest. You know, we always talk about vice presidential candidates. Are you going to do favorite sons? You know, you choose someone in some swing state. You hope you can pull a few more votes. Most people don't really think that vice presidential candidates matter. I think this time around it does matter for obvious reasons, given Joe Biden's age, the fact that, you know, many people believe, I would kind of agree, that he's showing signs of frailty and a little bit of a diminished capacity. The fact that looks like right now a large portion, probably a majority of Americans are going to vote for him, and may just indicate how much Trump is unpopular at the moment, you know, given those liabilities. But it does mean that a lot of people are going to be focused on his vice presence. And as we all know by now, Joe Biden promised several months ago it should be a woman. I think Joe Biden has actually made some very smart decisions over the last few months in staking out a moderate position. I don't think the whole, you know, it has to be a woman thing. It actually, you look at surveys, that decision alone does not draw over marginal voters, does not draw over the independent voter. Most Americans don't like the idea of, you know, they love the idea, at least in fiction, that you're going to look at, you know, the most capable candidate. People don't like quotas. I think it plays well, perhaps, to his left, to the more progressive wing of his party. But I will say, given that, I think Joe Biden has successfully portrayed himself as the moderate thus far. And I also think that many of these candidates would do pretty well. Many of them are moderates themselves, and would do him well running with them. I'm not sure about the most popular candidate. And if you go down and look again, predicted has odds. So if you want to know, yes, we do have a futures market on every single one of these candidates, and you can kind of tell who is expected to get the nod, and that is his erstwhile opponent, Kamala Harris, right? Kamala Harris apparently is a 48% odds, according to Predict It, of getting the nod. I'm not sure if that's going to happen. What's in her favor? Well, she's a California senator. On the other hand, it's a senator that it's a state that is absolutely going to vote Democratic. So I don't know what he gains by that. But, you know, she's a familiar person known to a lot of Democrats. She's known actually to a lot of Americans. She ran in the presidential race. Not a lot of that, I think, was to her benefit. She is charismatic. But I think, as we also saw in the debates, she's also can be catty and sardonic, which I don't think are great traits to match alongside Joe Biden's. She also has this long record of throwing people in jail, right? I mean, she's an attorney general. I mean, that's kind of what she is. And she's a nasty prosecutor. I think a lot of people have seen her on YouTube, you know, cross-examining, you know, the director of Homeland Security and so on. She's kind of vicious up there. She's not exactly a friendly, warm face. And obviously, like Biden, she is tarred in progressive circles with this long record of sort of, you know, tough attitude on crime, the sort of three strikes you're out attitude, which was very popular back in the late 1990s and coming into the 00s when she was getting her career started. But anyway, she's number one by far. She's African-American, which I think helps right now. But that's where she is. The second choice is Val Demings, who's a congresswoman from Orlando. She hasn't been in office very long. I think she's been in office since 2017. But for nearly 30 years, she was an officer in the Orlando Police Department and became chief of police for her last 4 years. She's charismatic. She's the daughter of non-college, low-income parents. She believes in the American dream. She is, I think she'd be a very appealing candidate, actually. She's definitely moderate. She is unironic, you know. I mean, just a little bit of a contrast with Kamala Harris. She is tough, but she's kind of all American. And she, too, is African-American. And I think she would make a very good running mate for him. Susan Rice is also tied at 14%. A lot of you know Susan Rice. She was Obama's national security advisor, ambassador to the UN before that. She has a long relationship with the Clintons before that. She's born in D.C. In almost everything you can talk about Susan Rice, I just say it's not very appealing. She's basically a creature of Washington. She's associated with the Republicans and conservatives for the Benghazi attack, for Russiagate, Obamagate. She's a scholar. I mean, she's the daughter of a Brookings economics scholar. She's a scholar herself. She doesn't have that same service record. And I think a lot of, particularly when you look at the sort of Russiagate, Obamagate, it left, I don't know. I think it would motivate a lot of independent voters, perhaps not in a favorable direction. I would say, on the other hand, just a little bit behind her at 11% now in predicted is Tammy Duckworth. And here again, I think this would be a very appealing vice presidential candidate for Joe Biden. She, as many people know, she served in the Army. She flew a combat helicopter in Iraq. And as a result of being blasted with a, you know, RPG, she lost both of her legs, and she has served. She worked at Veteran Affairs for the Obama administration. She is now senator from Illinois, and she's pro-gun. She's pro-military. She has led the charge, however, against Donald Trump. I think she would be a great choice, right? I mean, don't you agree, Christian? She's right in the middle, and she would really appeal to independents. I mean, if you're just looking, talking about, you know, gaining the middle ground, she would be perfect. She is mixed race, so to speak. She has a white father and a Thai mother, and she grew up in Asia. I believe she speaks a couple of Asian languages. I think she speaks Thai and some other language. She's not African-American. I don't know. That makes her, you know, not a twofer, right? She's a woman. On the other hand, I guess she's disabled. I don't know how to add all these things up. Christian, you can help me. Forgetting all the categorical stuff, I just think she would be a very appealing candidate. And then you go down the list from there. Elizabeth Warren's still hanging around at 8%. Obviously, that would be, you know, energize the left of her party. You know, she's white. I guess that's her problem. And I guess a lot of people say she's also annoying, right? That's her problem. but uh, But anyway, there you go. Michelle Obama is hanging out there at 5%. That would make a really interesting choice. I don't think that's going to happen. Michelle Lujan Grisham, who's governor of New Maryland. Now, she's Hispanic. She's Latina. And that would be interesting. She served as the Secretary of Health of New Mexico. She's been representative of New Mexico. She's, I don't know, born and raised in New Mexico. And she thinks a lot about agriculture. And so, but that would be great, obviously, and perhaps a help in the Southwest. And probably it turns out where Joe Biden may not need a lot of help anyway, right?
Right.
He may get most of those states. A couple of others down near the bottom here in terms of probability right now of at 4%. One is Keisha Lance Bottoms, who is Atlanta-born and raised. She's the mayor of Atlanta since 2017. And she had great visibility after the George Floyd protests. And she was very good at denouncing violence, sympathizing with the protesters, but getting them to back off a lot of the stuff which he thought would be very dangerous for the city and lead to a lot of, a lot of damage to the city and sort of warded off a lot of the looting that people actually feared. So her stock really went up in her response. She's progressive enough. I mean, she's mayor of Atlanta. She declared that Atlanta is off limits to ICE. So I guess you can say she's a sanctuary city mayor. I'm not sure that that's going to get her any traction among moderates, but you know she'll certainly be in with the Democrats on that one. And then a little bit further down, I guess maybe at the bottom of the list is Stacey Abrams, a very smart woman. She writes novels. She writes public policy essays. She has a doctorate in law from Yale Law School. And she had a big run for the governorship of Georgia in 2018. She barely lost to Brian Kemp. I don't know. I think she may be just a little bit too hot a candidate for Joe Biden, just meaning hot temperamentally. I mean, you hear her talk. I mean, she has an edge to her. She's very articulate, but she may kind of, I don't know, overshadow Slow Joe, right? I mean, I don't know. It's harder to see that combination. And there's a little bit, too, of sort of the progressive wing kind of, you know, tearing her away from Joe and kind of almost a proxy war. That would be a little bit of a difficult one. And then a few others are hanging on. Believe it or not, Hillary Clinton is at 2%. Hillary Clinton's on every one of these lists. Gretchen Whitmer, governor of Michigan. Unfortunately, she was the Ingham County prosecutor, and she was involved in, investigating the crimes of her predecessor. I don't know if there's a huge time now for former prosecutors. She did have a high-profile argument with Trump over the COVID response, and I think that actually, again, lifted her up in her public profile. I don't think she has a lot of chance of going anywhere. Tammy Baldwin is hanging in there. She's junior senator of Wisconsin. And finally, Amy Klobuchar, who I think, didn't she formally renounce? She just said, this should go to a woman of color. And I think that was her graceful way of bowing out, because in fact, what everyone is now talking about Amy Klobuchar is that she was the Hennepin County attorney in Minneapolis throughout the time when the officers accused of murdering George Floyd were there, and many complaints against them, and she did move against them. And she just realized, given the whole George Floyd situation, she just has to back off. So there you go. I think there would be, if men were being considered, actually some fairly decent men who would be considered. What about these names? Sherrod Brown, Cory Booker, Andrew Yang, Andrew Cuomo. What do you think, Christian? Those would all be respectable candidates, right?
Cuomo's pretty popular right now.
I don't. Yeah, and Cory Booker. I mean, that would be actually not a bad choice. But anyway, you're probably not going to see that. Again, we've been way beyond our time allotment. That's just we I don't know. We cut off more than we can always handle. But this has been great, Christian. Stay cool out there in the state of Maine.
You as well, Neil.
And thank all of you. Thank all of you for listening to this week's Demography Unplugged. Talk to you again next week. Thank you for joining me on this episode of Demography Unplugged. If you like what you've heard and want to dive deeper, I've got some good news for you. I'm offering a special research service for subscribers. It provides unique insights you won't see anywhere else. Deep dive analysis, charts, videos, and much more. It's designed to help professionals and investors uncover hidden trends and critical developments driving world markets and economies. You can learn more about it online at www.hedgeye.com, or you can just Google Demography Unplugged. You can also follow me on Twitter at HowGeneration. That's H-O-W-E Generation.
This content is for informational purposes and does not constitute an offer to sell or buy any investment vehicle, nor does it constitute an investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. Hedgeye believes the information sources to be reliable but is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions. The opinions expressed are those of the individual speaking. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information is protected by copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient provided access by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited and subject to the terms of service at hedgeye.com.